What's kicking around in your head?
Oh gosh, what's kicking around in my head? I've been so focused for so many years on trying to figure out how to take everything I've learned from my involvement with helping people in spiritual and whole being awakening, and figuring out how to make that apply with fantastic leverage. And so my head's been so deep into that that I've actually haven't spent that much time thinking that deeply about things that I'd like to get back to thinking about, including, what is consciousness and what does it mean for humans to realize that? And what does it mean when people focus too much on consciousness? I mean, consciousness isn't separate from anything, but because of how we grow and develop, it appears that way to a lot of people, in fact, to most people for periods of time. And I guess one of the things on my mind is trying to help people understand that it's consciousness is just a human perception of a, we could say, of a layer of what is. And that layer of what is universal. It's not based in the human brain. It's just something that humans have the unique capacity to recognize. And they can recognize it. People will also recognize it in their own unique ways. There are kind of standard markers about how people come to recognize that. But it's different, it's a little complicated. And so a lot of the ancient stuff we get from the East about consciousness and spiritual realization ends up resulting in a lot of misunderstanding about spirituality, realization, how it's supposed to bring perfect peace and happiness, things like that. I mean, part of what I've been up to for many years in my work has been to demythicize what spiritual awakening is about and make it practical and accessible.
What does that entail? Stripping away the mythical elements.
Starting with, I had, I think I'm going to post it. I have it posted on one of my websites. It's called channelted.com. And there's an essay there. There's a pile of essays that are really designed to demythicize people's beliefs about these things. One of them is called The Self You Didn't Want to Realize. Because people think that they want to realize the ultimate perfect self, and that they think that that's kind of like the bliss of a thousand suns, and that it's going to make everything perfect and stuff like that. And yeah, it's not like people don't have experiences like that. It's just that those kinds of descriptions are out of this world. And it's not like, it's not like they're not true. It's just that they're experiences, and experiences are states. They come and they go, and that's not what gets stabilized. What gets stabilized is the realization that the infinite is part of everything that is, and it doesn't in itself fix anything, except it does give you the ability to stay completely centered in that part of yourself. And when you're centered in consciousness, nothing can throw you off the way it used to, because a big part of yourself is anchored in what we could say is a safe place, the only safe place in the universe. It's the only quotes place in the universe that you could say is beyond space and time, while at the same time I'm saying it's not separate. But when that part of you is awake and you're deeply rooted in that, then it's very much like a ship with a big deep rudder. Whatever comes up, you're still there, not selling yourself out to avoid pain, for instance, which is what I think the whole world is mostly doing. It's what everybody does until we can't, until we can do better. I think it's just part of the development process. We become very conditioned, as we should be when we're very young, to avoid pain and to make ourselves happy and comfortable. But then I think that the search for happiness just sort of keeps amping up and amping up. And for some people, it turns into a search for perfect bliss through consciousness awakening. And when they start, what's weird about that is when they start having consciousness awakenings, it can make them temporarily happy, but then they can get addicted to that particular way of being seated in consciousness in a way that isn't so good. Like, well, the way to say it would be addicted to being in consciousness as if it were separate. Addicted to going there as if that was going to fix the rest of their life. As if meditating, for instance, was going to fix their, you know, overdue taxes or something.
Yeah, it won't.
Yeah, it won't. You know, and I'm here to say I figured that out. Speaking from my own experience. Seriously, speaking from my experience as a type 7 on the Enneagram, always seeking happiness and fun. And I spent a huge amount of time in my earlier years being, meditating and doing yoga and breathing exercises all day for years as part of the transcendental meditation movement and training to become a teacher of that. And coming out of that, finding that that didn't really satisfy most of my needs, searching for other ways to make myself happy, and then finally met a teacher who helped me realize that that just keeps me dissociated from life, because life isn't all fun. So, you know, if you happen to be a type 7 out there, whoever's listening, there is a huge realization in the acceptance of life being both happy and sad, up and down, always changing. A huge realization in the acceptance that that's just as much who we are spiritually as consciousness. Like this body and its needs, this mind, these emotions, everything that makes up who we are as humans. These are just as fundamental to our spiritual life as the experience of spirit or consciousness. And until that realization comes, the best we can hope to do is recognize, realize, even have deep, profound realizations of consciousness or spirit. But that doesn't get us to the next place. And I think a lot of people are confused because they don't know what that next place is. You know, to me, the next place is the union, the realization of unity. Some people call it Christ consciousness. It's this recognition that, oh my God, everything is one. I am one. My body is part of the one. My own needs, my darknesses, my light. It's all just all part of the same thing. My pain actually is just as sacred as my happiness. And when you get to that place, you can drop into this realization of unity that goes way beyond just the recognition or realization of consciousness in its own right. But even that started happening in larger numbers back in the 90s, but that's not the whole picture. And so I found myself going on this endless quest for what's beyond that. You know, what's beyond the realization of consciousness? Okay, what's beyond the realization of unity? And that took me into, well, having to recognize, yeah, unity is really what most people experience as a unity realization is really just a recognition that has to learn to be embodied. It doesn't change all of those old patterns that were based in the duality-based conditioning as we were growing up. And so even though we may know unity is true, and we may be walking around in the world in that unified realization, it doesn't mean that that unity has actually penetrated through all of the way we actually interact with ourselves in the world. Because we have been deeply conditioned to think of ourselves as separate. And even when we realize on some level that we're not separate, to do business in the world with others and with other entities and other things in a way in which we really know that it's all one thing on all levels, all right up through the physical, that's the next phase after unity. And I think few people have been able to describe that well. I know there are some who have, but it's still like that's just at the beginning. Like that's the edge right now, as far as I can tell. That's one of the big edges, and that requires us to sort out relationship. The we space thing. That's why that whole thing is becoming big, I think, because the recognition is it's not just subjective. You know, if it's really going to be unity, we really got to work between self and other in a way that brings that unity all the way through ourselves and our actions. I think I'll pause. As you can tell, I can rant probably for hours.
Well, I don't think what you're saying has the emotional charge of a rant. You're just talking about things that you think about often and yep. In depth.
It's true.
You know, when I talk along these lines, I can pretty much count on getting some feedback from somebody, sometimes somebody in particular, but sometimes somebody I wasn't expecting to get it from. But it's usually the same message. And that is, you know, consciousness, mindfulness, meditation, these are buzzwords in the corporate go-getter set right now. These, mm-hmm. you know, mindfulness has been eagerly embraced by the achievers of the world. And the criticism that I get is that, you know, this is being used for utility purposes. You know, it's being used basically mm-hmm. as a cognitive enhancer or a performance enhancing drug. And it is stripped of any ethical connotation. You know, it's just technique. And the technique by itself, removed from the context of the ethical crisis, you know, that is the foundation of Buddhism, makes it unworthy somehow. And I have a standard response that I usually think, if not, you know, type when I get this communication. But what is your response to that challenge?
Well, yeah, this has been called spiritual materialism, right? It's like using spirituality as a way to improve our daily lives. And my response to that is awesome. Would you rather we take drugs that like tear down our body while giving us these groovy experiences? I think, look, it's a stage. People go through this stage, you know, on our model. This is chapter 4, Rational Striving. People are trying to make a dent in the world. They're trying to figure out who they are and what their gifts are and how to take care of themselves and how to give their gifts. It's important. They have to do that. And if they turn to spirituality to help give them some support on that, well, great. They've got a motivation to start waking up. I don't care if it's a motivation that later on might seem like it's changed, that their motivations become more broad or more inclusive. That's just how it's supposed to be. And I think that at least at this point, we've evolved to the place where we can see that tapping into our spiritual selves, the spiritual layer of ourselves, which isn't separate, the more we awaken to that part, the more effective we are. I think it's a good thing to realize that it helps us to be better people, more effective, more productive people. Maybe it helps us to make more money. Is that a bad thing? I think for people who are thinking about money and spirituality as separate, that's a bad thing. If they're thinking about spirituality and the body as being separate things, or spirituality and our emotions as being separate things, yeah, they'll think that's a bad thing, inappropriate use, and that's also a stage. So I think I honor the stage. I've been through the stage. It's a beautiful thing that we have needs that keep evolving. And I think to me, one of the essential things I've learned over the course of my life in helping a huge number of people with their spiritual awakenings is that in a way it's kind of about, it's not about like meditating, like the way I used to, like doing all these techniques for years and years over and over and trying to sort of break through some sort of an inner wall or something. It's about getting needs met. It's about, you know, just like as babies, if you help the baby get love and warmth and clothing and shelter and, you know, some gazing with mom and everything that babies need to feel safe here. Well, this is what Abraham Maslow first started pointing out. I totally agree. It's like it's needs-based. You help those needs get met and we grow. We get to the next stage and those needs are still there. Our physical survival needs are, and our needs for love and warmth and belonging are always going to be there. But then we expand to have more needs. We have needs to discover who we are in ourselves, getting into chapter two, self-centric. And like that, that's what this whole model that Carol and I came up with is all about, showing how it's all about needs and not about, you know, achievement in particular, although achievement happens by meeting needs.
You know, as you were saying that, I was thinking the people who are most likely to take up some sort of meditative practice in the service of improving their business abilities, their material needs are already met for the most part.
Yeah, right.
They don't need to have that level of Maslow's hierarchy shored up for them so that they can move on to something, you know, closer to the apex. But it does seem that, you know, at least from my own experience, I can say that when I was down to my last $100,000 in my checking account, I had sleepless nights worrying about running out of money. And then I ran out of money, you know, decade and a half ago, and I sleep fine now.
Yeah, so you're saying some of those needs are a bit illusory.
They cannot be satisfied in the way we imagine they can be.
That's true. I mean, there's a certain way in which as human beings we're designed on some level to never be satisfied. Like we're always driving towards something more. Always. You know, you can have beautiful, huge, and even very deep and stable realizations of consciousness, unity, singularity, whatever you want to call all that. And still, something drives us forward. Something tends to make us want to express more, to help more, to have things be more expressed. You know, in the same sort of way that I think parents want their kids to be all of who their kids can be. There's a way that evolutionary love, the more it awakens, it just wants everything to be its best. Everyone and everything. And that is just reflecting the evolutionary impulse of the whole universe, as far as I can tell. It's the same thing. It's all constantly growing. You could step back and say, well, the universe doesn't need anything. It's got everything. So why is the universe evolving? Answer, I don't know. It's just what it is. You know? So that's where we are. That's part of what we are. Anyway, that's how I see that.
Oh, let me ask you about the manipulation of public consciousness or mass consciousness through deep data analytics and big data. I've noticed in the last few days there has been another furor about Cambridge Analytica and its ability to, you know, acquire data about users via Facebook and then target what's called dark advertising at specific people to get them to make a specific choice in a specific moment and then delete the ad so that there is no no record of, you know, what they said to whom in order to get them to vote a certain way. And I was trying to raise the alarm about this a while back, and I was getting a lot of resistance from folks who are now very interested in the story. Now that somehow this activity has been linked with Russian interference. There is no link, but I noticed that, like, if I hear a short story about it on NPR, they will somehow find a way to mention the Russia interference and Cambridge Analytica in the same sentence, even though they're two completely different topics. And
wow.
I'm seeing this in the Washington Post, which I see regularly because it comes pre-installed on my my Amazon tablet, and you know Jeff Bezos owns the Post. So, and the Post is an explicitly, like, not even hiding it, anti-Trump newspaper. They changed the motto of the paper to "Democracy Dies in Darkness." After this, yeah, I mean, it says that on the home screen.
Someone's taking a stand.
This doesn't seem like a balanced stand at all. Anyway,
no, it's not a balanced stand, but I guess some people have to like feel they have to go to the other side of the balance beams to help things balance out.
But now that somebody has thought to, you know, make a tenuous or even fanciful connection between, you know, Robert Mercer and him placing Steve Bannon in the Trump campaign and the use of analytics from Cambridge Analytica to sway the election. Now that that's all been connected in the public mind with the Russian interference in the way that, you know, the Bush administration connected 9/11 with Saddam Hussein, there was no connection. But they established one just by saying the two things in the same sentence again and again and again. It created, you know, a mental connection. Mm-hmm. Now that that's been done, it's a topic of interest. I can bring it up and people will engage with it. Not in any productive way that I can tell, but at least it's on the radar. So you can probably tell a lot about my position from the way I've described the situation.
Yeah.
So I'll turn it over to you.
Yeah, well, so here's the thing. there are stages of human evolution during which we are highly susceptible to influences from the outside that force the way we're thinking, and the way we're thinking does have an impact on the choices we make and the effects we have on others in the world. And the problem here, in a certain way, the bigger problem here is sort of reminds me of this analogy. If you've got, you know, if you leave the sink on and it's flooding all over the kitchen and water's going everywhere, it doesn't matter how many other, you know, bringing in the mops or the wet dry vac or anything else. It doesn't matter all that stuff because the water keeps leaking. The real issue here is going there. And the analogy here is that in our lives, we're so much at the influence of these things. We don't know that we're leaking out of ourselves. And the way to stop all of that is to come back in and realize consciousness, because once you've realized consciousness, you can watch what's going on from within yourself. You can watch you can watch how ads try to manipulate. You can watch how everybody's agenda is trying to manipulate you. You can start to see, oh, this person wants that. That's them. This is me. That's not what I want. That's what they want. And you can't see that until you're awake enough to actually watch your own mind. If you're not awake enough to watch your own mind and understand what's going on and watch your own body and watch your own emotions and watch your own patterning and your own conditioning, you'll never get out of it. It's just currently back in watching one of the great movies I love from a long time ago, which is The Truman Show. It's so much like that. It's like everybody's trying to get Truman to be part of ads and do things that they want him to do because it's part of their TV thing and they're all making money. But Truman starts realizing there's something bigger and that that isn't what he wants. And I think that's the journey we all have to go through. I think that the world is going to always have its agendas. The average consciousness of the world is never going to be up to the most developed of any group of or single person or any group of people. So there's always going to be these things going on where people are trying to manipulate each other, and they'll use all the technology they can get their hands on to do it, because they'll make more money. And until they get that they're not fulfilling their own larger needs through that, they'll just keep doing that. So I don't think the problem can be solved by just going after all of these exterior issues. You see what I mean? It's like, it doesn't matter. There's just be different issues. You fix one issue, there will be like 10 million other issues, 10 million other ways in which people are manipulating each other and doing bad things. And we're not going to stop that. I mean, we'll do our best, but it's never going to become perfect. Speaking of which, I used to be an idealist. Then I thought, oh, this is great. You know, we'll get everybody in the world awake and everything is going to be groovy. Yeah, I don't think so. I really don't think so. I think the best we can hope for is a constant evolution, and that evolution can be big. It will go through some very major steps, but it's never going to be perfect. People aren't ever going to get to a place where, there's nothing bad happening, or, all their problems are fixed. All society's problems are fixed. I don't believe that anymore. I don't believe that. But it can be a hell of a lot better than it is, and it will continue to be. And I think that one of the first and major keys to that is people have to wake up to the point where they can actually be aware of their own participation in this mystery, their own conditioning, their own wounding, their own awakening, their own gifts, their own limits. We have to get to that point. Otherwise, it doesn't matter how many different things you go after. Still going to be the same basic story, in my opinion. Anyway, I hope that was made some sense.
Oh, it made some sense. It also sparked a couple of associations, one of which is among a certain category of the Sea Realm audience, a certain subset, there is a strong, strong emotional need to condemn one Jordan Peterson right now. And a lot of the condemnations of Jordan Peterson, do you know who Jordan Peterson is?
No.
Oh, okay. He is a Canadian college professor and a psycho, well, I don't know exactly what type of therapist he is. He's a Jungian in his academic interest, and I don't know to what extent that informs his clinical practice. But he came to fame a couple of years ago by refusing to abide by some edict that, he called everybody by their preferred pronouns, and people were free to, choose whatever pronoun they want. And there were 70 or more proliferating at that time, and people weren't under any obligation to use the same pronoun from day to day. Just whatever they wanted to be called, he, as a professor, was required to call them that. And he made a public refusal. He just said, "No, I'm not going there." And this brought him to attention of people who are, anti-political correctness and irritated with social justice, leading edge campaigning and activism. And eventually it took him to the Joe Rogan podcast. And one appearance on Joe Rogan is, Joe Rogan is a star maker these days. If you get on his show, you are known. You are known to a great many people. And so now Jordan Peterson is quite famous for this. He makes about $50,000 a month on Patreon, people just pledging small amounts because they like what he's doing. And it has catalyzed a very strong negative reaction against him. On certain parts of the social oriented left. And I see a lot of really, really bad faith criticisms of Jordan Peterson. But one that isn't necessarily, bad faith from the ground up is one that I thought of when you were talking about how, we're never going to fix the world's problems. People need to focus on their own relationship to consciousness and come to understand their own reactions to external stimulation better, and that will help them, make more informed and conscious choices and participate better. One of the criticisms of Jordan Peterson is that, and his audience is largely young men. It's, it's mostly men and largely young men who are attracted to his message. And the criticism that I've heard, which, I do take somewhat seriously, is that Jordan Peterson's message is largely one of self-help. It's largely one of taking responsibility for your own actions and taking responsibility for the cumulative consequences of your past actions and, being a better man. And that putting the focus on the individual like that and telling young men to think about, their own lives and the way they're conducting themselves as individuals takes them out of the political sphere. It removes them, it basically blinds them to the whole panoply of options that come with coordinated social action and political action. And, it's largely Marxists, and Jordan Peterson is openly critical of Marxism, so he's, drawing a lot of hate from that side of the left. But basically, focusing inward, focusing on oneself, in some respects, divorces you from collective action.
Right. So this is one of the reasons that Ken Wilber, I think, brought forth a super important insight with his four quadrants. The four quadrants. Well, we've renamed them, but there's the subjective experience. There's other people's exterior experience of you, which can happen through machines. So, for instance, the subjective experience could be I'm having a certain, thoughts about my wife. And the exterior experience could be my brainwaves are going a certain way. So they're subjective and objective. The relational quadrant is about what's happening subjectively, culturally, between people. So the stuff, the feelings, the ideas, the stuff, the experiences we share, our feelings about them, our subjective experience of all that in community with two or more people. We call that relational. And then there's the systemic, is our name for the lower right quadrant in Ken's system, which is the exterior collective, the systems, political systems, physical systems, all of the support systems that are there that we build and that are also already there, like the physical universe and nature, things like that. Those are physical systems. And they're not just physical, they're on all levels. So we've got these four views of life, and they're always accessible at all times. They're always happening at all times. But if we get too focused on any one of them, we get in trouble. So I want to make sure I'm not leaving you with the impression that I'm saying it's all about just being subjective. There are certain periods of our development where it is very much about awakening subjectively. But that's not enough. That's one part of it. We also have to realize that we are part of society and each other and this whole world. And so we have to become aware of what's happening both internally and externally. And we need to participate on all of these levels. Because if we get too overly focused on any one of these, it's not going to be holistic and we're going to get imbalanced. People who think that it's just all about fixing politics. There's only so far you can go with that, right? Good. I'm glad people are doing it. I want people to do it. People must do it. And I participate in whatever ways I can to help the external systems evolve. But I guess the main thing I want to say about all that is let's not get over-focused on any one of these perspectives. They're all necessary at different times in our individual and collective awakening process. No one of them is a magic bullet by itself. No person is an island by themselves. And there is no one truth that's going to bring light to the entire world. There's just this huge, immense complexity of everything. And I think one of the challenges is learning how to awaken in all of these perspectives in our lives so that we can actually be as happy, as productive, as fulfilling for our own unique purpose as we possibly can.
Is there a link to your version of the four quadrants to an image of it that I can get?
On iconscious.global, people can go in and get a free membership and go into the interactive model. And there is just a picture. The model includes the four views in the top left corner, and it also includes the five domains on the left side.
Hi, I'm Ted Strauss.
Which is consciousness,
Hi.
Uniqueness, emotions, mind, and body.
Okay. And I'm on the iConscious page right now.
Yeah.
Just on the main page. Where would I go to get that?
I think it says model.
Mm-hmm. Model and treasury.
Yeah. Yep. And so are you seeing it?
Well, it's asking me to log in now, so I'm doing that.
Okay.
Okay, now it says the iConscious Human Development Model.
Yep.
And there is a color graphic which has got text that is entirely too small for me to read.
Yes, that's right. Level of it's hard to read. So if you hit the plus button in the lower left corner, you can zoom up on it, and then you can click and hold and shove it around.
So where would I find the four quadrant graph?
Okay, the four quadrants are in the top left there where it says views. subjective, objective, relational, systemic.
I see.
And see, right now we're at the place where we're not, we haven't quite ready, we're not quite ready to launch this to the public at the level that we're working up to. But what's going to happen is in the views, when you click one of those four views, what'll happen is all the statements that are to the right of domains and down below the top headers, these are all these statements are going to change to reflect that view. So if you hit subjective, it'll all be statements about what that particular stage of development is like from the inside. And then if you hit objective, you'll get information about what that looks like from the outside. And then when you hit relational, you'll find out what that feels like in groups internally as we evolve. And then on the lower right, the systemic, well, I'm saying lower right, referring to Ken Wilber's model, but the systemic will bring up all the statements that are about the systems that we're able to think about and participate in as we evolve. And then those systems just become more and more inclusive as we grow. We can see and understand more of that. And then I guess I just want to point out to your listeners that the domain's dimension in our model, we feel, is its own really important insight that people need to understand. These are five fundamental levels of human experience that if we don't put them up there all at the same time and understand that they're all part of who we are, then people tend to miss this. People tend to miss all of these five at once.
So the five are body, mind, emotions, uniqueness, and consciousness.
Exactly. And yeah, these days, there's so much more talk about consciousness that more and more people are aware of it. And certainly people have always been aware of their body and their mind. A lot of people are not that aware of their emotions, or they're only aware of a narrow range of their own emotions. And a lot of people, it takes them a long time to get the deep, deep significance and importance of how unique every person is and how perfect that is, and how part of their evolution is all about becoming their own unique self in the same sort of a way that, let's say, a seed eventually will grow and flower in its own particular way that's different than other plants and has its own gifts to bring to the environment because of that. Because when we're young, it's like the pressures of conformity are enormous for the sake of our survival. And that's also described in the model. Survival is the first chapter. So these pressures of conformity make us feel like who we are uniquely isn't that important, and we should try to find a way to fit in because we need to feel like we belong, and we need to feel like we're going to survive. But sooner or later, as we're breaking out of chapter three, conforming, and going into rational striving, which is very much about the self-responsibility stage, and beyond that, we start realizing that, yeah, I'm speaking again from experience. You know, I spent decades doing spiritual techniques, figuring that was just going to like solve everything, only to realize I didn't know who I was personally. Like I was starting to realize who I was spiritually, but that was only like part of who I was. And, you know, I'd say even 10 years ago, I would have said something like spirituality is just as important as the humanness. And it's absolutely true. And now I would go further and I would say, there is nothing about spirituality or spirit or consciousness that is any more important or is in any way superior to or is in any way even the source of the humanness, the physicality, the emotions, and all these parts of our humanity. Why do I say that that's... Because everybody else in the whole world has always been saying consciousness is the ultimate, the superior, the source, the blah, 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 blah. That is a split view. You can only say that if you can see that as a separate thing and put that value on it. And you know what? When you're in chapter 7 on the model, that your whole being is wanting you to value it that way. There's nothing wrong with that. It's just that that's not the whole picture. You know, as you go past those realizations, you start finding out that everything is, because it's all the same thing. Everything is important. Nothing is superior. It's just there's different levels of reality that are going on, and they're all part of the same thing. I don't know. Hopefully that made some sense.
Well, you were making reference to various stages in the model. I'm just going to read off these chapters, as you call them, in order so that the listeners will have a better idea of what you're making reference to. Chapter 1, survival. Chapter 2, self-centric. Chapter 3, conforming. 4, rational striving. 5, equality, harmony. 6, inclusive. 7, awakening. 8, oscillating. 9, embody unity. 10, transforming. 11, individuating. 12, living potential. And how can I scroll to the right here?
Click and drag it. To the left.
13, yeah. Singular realization. 14, fluidity. 15, radiant freedom. And 16, unknown.
Unknown.
Ongoing evolution, it says.
Yeah, we wanted to memorialize the unknown in the model because we got sick of hearing spiritual teachers say, I promise you X, Y, Z is the highest realization there is, which is like really stupid. There is no highest realization. We're evolving constantly. It's never going to end. It's really clear to me. And so I think the reason, you know, forgive me for making such a blanket statement about that. It's just that, you know, in the rest of our scientific endeavors, it's become really clear that there is no ultimate truth. There is only the evolving recognition of what is. And so, and that sort of stands at odds with a lot of Eastern tradition that's in which people are used to accepting these grand statements from the gurus as if that's the ultimate truth without testing it. And that's not the way I see things. I think that it's good to bring both subjective and objective and all kind, you know, all of these perspectives into the investigation of what human development is about. And I think the more you do that, the more perfectly obvious it is that there is no such thing as an end to human evolution, which is another way of saying we have no idea really what the ultimate potential of human beings is. But we can see that there are certain potential, that there are patterns in how people grow into their potential. And this iConscious model is the result of looking at thousands of people growing and standing back and going, okay, right, everybody's different. You know, they show up with all these different themes at different times. But on the balance, if you stand back and look at it, throw a grid over the whole thing, it looks like this to us. And the more we define what that is and then start assessing people through that and asking them about their experience, the more we find that this generally does appear to be true. I mean, there is ways in which even I may not, you know, if I go back and look at my past, there's a couple of places where I feel like I, you know, only lightly went through certain places and then sort of came back and went through them more later. And there are certainly ways in which I was way more focused on certain domains like consciousness and uniqueness for myself, and then came back and realized the importance of my emotions and my body. But basically, yeah, I think I would encourage your readers to go and check out for themselves this model and see how it corresponds to their experience, and be aware that we're just talking about averages. But I think even I have not yet seen an exception where people look at this and say, no, that doesn't look right. That's not my experience. I think if people have been at this and watched themselves grow for long enough, they'll see these patterns.
So chapter 4, rational striving. We've talked about that, and that the idea that you can engage in a type of mindfulness meditation which is going to demonstrate its value to you by increasing your income or getting you a promotion or, you know, achieving the approval of somebody who can help you out. The stage after that is, or the chapter after that is equality harmony, promoting oneness by battling hierarchical differences together. Would you talk about that?
This, let's say,
I should also
when
say
you've
that
gone.
oneness there is in quotes, promoting oneness by battling hierarchical differences together.
Yeah, in chapter four, there's still a material orientation. So for most people, when we are born here, and for the first several chapters of development, there's a lot of focus on our bodies and our physical needs and our sort of more fundamental needs of development. And these are very much around material needs. There are other needs that are being met. There are emotional needs being met. But generally speaking, our awareness tends to be more fixated on the exteriors of things, because that's actually meets our needs at that stage the best for most people. But once you've gone through enough of the rational striving, you start rotting out of that. You start like discovering, well, okay, I've got all this money. Okay, I've got the wife. I've got the car. I've got this and I got that. But something is still not fulfilled. Something is still feels very much missing. Something feels wrong or off or incomplete. And so there's this sense of being drawn into the more subtle, something that's more universal, something that's more connective. And so our awareness starts going down to the more subtle realms, which includes more attention on emotions, more attention on consciousness, and more attention on the subtle energies that are happening in our experience. And the focus is less on, okay, like, our, you know, it's less on the material achievements, and it's more, in a sense, on subtle achievements, or so at least let's say subtle experience, because we're trying to open the deeper, more subtle parts of our being. But while we're doing that, it's really easy to get confused between the values of chapter four and the values of chapter five and above, because we get this sense that, okay, well, these kind of regimented, hierarchical, materialistic values that are associated with chapter four didn't bring me everything I wanted. There's something deeply missing about that. And once you get to, you know, you're getting into chapter five, you start feeling that more acutely. So there's this tendency to go exploring into things that are less about dividing and more about including, more about connecting, more about getting more subtle. So people getting into all kinds of new age explorations. And it's not just new age, it's sort of, you know, on the exteriors, it very much got expressed through the 60s. You know, the music and the ideas in the theater production of Hair just like really brought it home what those values are a lot about. And so during that chapter five period, a lot of what happens is people can often think about oneness as some sort of conglomeration of good people in a more peer oriented relationship with each other. Here to support love and oneness, that sort of feeling and idea. And the reason we put quotes around oneness is because that's not the kind of oneness we mean when you realize unity. When you realize unity, you have to get beyond this place of thinking that oneness is an energetic experience. Yeah. It is, there can be energetic experiences of oneness, but that's only part of what oneness is. Oneness goes way beyond the energy of those things, and it includes all these five domains and all these four views. I don't know. Is there more to say about that?
On rational striving, there was a time when I had the house, I had the wife, I had the luxury car,
yep.
And I don't have any of that anymore. And I'm not particularly interested in reacquiring it, or at least not going about it directly, you know, not making that the goal and then striving directly for that. But the world and many people in it tell me that I'm not taking care of number four, and that, you know, I have no business seeking meaning in life or focusing on conversations about, you know, non-personal subjects or, you know, transpersonal experience or politics or, you know, ecology or sustainability. That all of that's airy-fairy stuff for people who have really got number four nailed down, and you don't. So get back to number four and do it.
Yeah. Thanks for embodying that so beautifully. That was great. You know, I guess it's because of just who I am uniquely as a type seven. I just never bought into that. Because of that, there's parts of me that are still working on that. But, you know, to me, all that says is that people are where they are. They can't see beyond where they are, and they're not supposed to. And it's just part of how it is. Sure, there's always going to be people saying stuff like that. There's always going to be people who can't see the wholeness of what's going on. We'll just give you their opinion. And in fact, I think there may even always be, that's another whole conversation, but there may always be that the average evolution of any population is lower than any individuals who are on the leading edges of further evolution. And so from those who are further on the leading edges, it's always going to look like, damn, why are these people so slow to wake up and evolve and see the bigger picture? I just don't, you know, I'm actively involved in trying to help accelerate evolution by cutting out all the lack of knowledge and lack of understanding and lack of direct experience that's possible, that we already have all the technologies for. It's really just about distributing it in a way that works. But even so, you know, I maintain that human life is always going to be a striving for more. And I think the more we understand about who we are and what that means to always be striving for more and learning how to embrace that feeling of striving for more, you know, the part of us that is, you know, yes, you can realize, you can have a realization that essentially makes you content. But that contentment doesn't mean it's not also going to be mixed with sadness, pain, striving for more. I think it's the orientation toward these things that really makes such a big difference in our lives. Like, we can feel content if we're not running from our discontent. If we embrace our discontent and our pain and our strugglings and our strivings, just as much as we embrace our ideals and the experiences that we most value, if we have equal values on these things, well, this is what some people call balanced view or a more enlightened perspective. It's not about making everything perfect. This is, you know, when you're down in these less evolved places, it looks like it's all about getting to the peak experience or climbing to the top of some kind of a mountain and we're going to stay there and it's going to be great. But once you've climbed to the top of a mountain and then fell down again, and you can't get back up to try and do that same search, and you start just feeling what's here at the bottom of the mountain, that is a path that takes you toward a kind of contentment that can't possibly be achieved through rational striving alone.
Well, that's probably a good place to leave off. We are just past the 1 hour mark, and recordings get unwieldy when they get longer than that.
Yeah.
So, Ted Strauss, I've really enjoyed our conversation. And thanks for spending the time with me.
Thanks, KMO. It's been great.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.